Welcome to the Interside Radio program. My name is Scooter, and I'll be with you for the next half an hour. I'd like to thank all the good folks who contributed to our fun drive last week, and we're still here, thanks to all of you. I was remiss in not thanking the lovely Nancy last week, who called in a pledge during the Jimmy Carper Memorial. I got a little carried away and didn't do a lot of pitching on that show, but she called in anyway. Thank you, Nancy. If you'd like to hear that program, you can easily find it by Googling The Inner Side, where most Inner Side radio programs are archived. And once again, Jimmy, you'll be sorely missed. He was a wonderful man. On with the show. I'd like to start out with a terrific example of Pan-African Black nationalism that was forwarded to me by a listener. This is some very articulate white guys from Christian radio who are truly a credit to their race, so God bless them.
Be happy, don't worry, be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate, but don't worry. Be happy.
But the best Catholic priests I've seen in this country are from Africa. Africa. Intelligent men with PhDs. Not that a PhD means much, because you know what they say that stands for nowadays very often.
And
but
generally, the African from Africa is a very pro-American person, a very happy person. I know several, and they just always happy with a joke, pleasant smile on their face, and they clearly don't identify with the surliness that's all too frequently the attitude of their fellow African Americans here. So it's and they're very conservative politically. Like the country of Ghana, it's still illegal to commit an abortion. It's illegal to be homosexual. Very conservative social laws and very free market oriented as well.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Now, we do have to place this in perspective, because you'll also hear, and this is true as well, that black immigrants, or I should say African immigrants, in England, for instance, do better economically and educationally than native Englishmen do nowadays. And here, they're a high-performing group as well, but the perspective needed is you have to remember something. What kinds of Africans could actually get here? Well, unlike with Mexico, we don't share a border with Africa, so it's not the case that just any poor African can wander into our country. The fact is that to get here, you've got to take an airplane, so you have to have some means, you have to have some wherewithal. So the Africans who come here in the first place, I would say, in general, tend to be of a better stripe. They tend to be educated. They tend to maybe be a little more upper class than a lot of the Africans who can't get here.
It's the way we used to run our immigration system altogether.
Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry. Be happy.
Yeah,
no matter
exactly.
Who, where you came from.
Exactly.
But these are folks that really stand apart, and hopefully they can approach some of their fellow blacks and say, "Hey, buddy, you got this all wrong. Let me explain to you the way the world really works."
All right. I think most real Americans prefer their Africans with better stripes. Words of wisdom from right-wing Christian talk radio, broadcasting from a dominion near you. Speaking of fundamentalist douchebaggery in the news, Bill Nye traveled to Kentucky this week to the multi-million-dollar creationist museum for a debate with young earth creationist entrepreneur Ken Ham. Now, my favorite exhibit at the Creationist Museum is a child riding on a baby dinosaur in a life-size animatronic Garden of Eden diorama. And it's not meant as a joke, because Before the fall of man, all the people and animals and dinosaurs, dragons and crocoducks lived in splendorous, loving harmony. This was back when even T-Rex was a vegetarian. This is before that bitch Eve ruined everything. Now, anyone with a basic knowledge of science can see the problems and possible inaccuracies with this depiction. There's one thing that is known to be an unimpeachable fact. There were no children in the Garden of Eden. They didn't come along until after we were cast out. So Ken Ham is obviously taking at least some liberties with the truth based on my copy of the Bible. The topic of the debate was, is creation a viable model of origins? And it should be pointed out that Ham's version of creationism promotes the idea that not only the Earth, but the entire universe is only 6,000 years old. This particular belief, or some version of it, is accepted by over 20% of the U.S. population, despite some science-y type evidence to the contrary, which is really pissing my dog off. What is interesting is that the science and skeptic community are split on whether Bill Nye should have debated a waterhead like Ham, implying that it lent credibility to this type of lunacy. Now, this is based on Richard Dawkins' repeated refusal to debate fringy, delusional young Earth creationists in the past, which I agree with. But Dawkins is an academic scholar and a bona fide, well-known evolutionary biologist, and would lend credibility to this sort of crackpot ramblings you can hear from any glue sniffer hallucinating outside a Greyhound station. However, Bill Nye is not known as a learned academic in the field of biology. He is an engineer by training and an entertainer by reputation who focuses on popularizing science. So he should not be held to the same constraints. Anybody with a television knows that entertainment doesn't have any standards at all. Also, Bill Nye went on to Ham's turf for the debate and therefore gained access to his audience, not the other way around. And nobody from Bill Nye's audience listening in could possibly have been persuaded by any of Ken Ham's nonsense. The thing got huge publicity on all the major networks, allowing a huge audience to be exposed to the bat-spit craziness of young Earth creationism, and why thinking people are upset with this sort of nonsense being widespread and why we don't want it in our school systems. We're not just a bunch of obnoxious atheist meanies trying to ruin everybody's Sunday morning. People really believe this stuff, and it's a powerful political agenda. If you can get people to believe this stuff, they'll believe anything, which is a good start for corporate authoritarian overlords. The target audience of a debate is always the fence sitters, not the immovables. So I think it was a great idea, and I've cruised discussions and polls from hardcore Christian websites that suggest Bill Nye was successful in overcoming a measure of confirmation bias from that audience. 93% of responders to a poll on the Christian Today website agreed that Bill Nye won the debate. To borrow a phrase from one of America's greatest Christians, George Bush, mission accomplished. Let's go to Reggie Watts for some real biological science. This is from a new series called Teach, and here's Reggie doing some teaching. Check it out.
Biology, sublimation is one of the most common chemical reactions. And in this reaction, we are generally forming conduit relays to DNA and RNA substructures. So if you'd please take a look into your microscopes and see what I have for you.
What is this?
Welcome to biology, people. Welcome to biology, okay? All right, settle down, okay? After seeing that, now you know the secret of how all life functions. So let's talk about protons. Protons are four tons, okay? Now there are contons, okay? Contons are not four tons. How many of you have seen The Empire Strikes Back? Anybody? So you're familiar with tontons, okay? So there are tontons, there are protons, and contons, okay? There's also Decepticons. So let's talk about the fourth dimension. Now, do you see where this pin is?
Yes.
Okay, do you see where it is now?
Yes.
Okay, how about here?
Yes.
Okay, can you see where this pin is right now?
No.
That's because you see in three dimensions. Our universe is three-dimensional, but it is governed by a fourth dimension, which enables us to live and exist between a sandwich of dimensions. We live in a dimensional sandwich. Okay, who here can tell me what the fastest thing in the universe is? You.
Sound.
Close. Anybody else?
Sound.
Okay. No? It's the cheetah. So I'm gonna take a little bit of a tour here and just make some notes, check out what you see from your little critters in the microscope. You should be seeing two protozoic single-celled organisms using their flagellum, rotating towards each other. After we've added the yeast food proteins, you should be seeing the single-celled organisms absorbing the food. What is your problem?
I really want to see the, I can't, I don't know, it's not working.
Have you tried leaning in and looking into the microscope?
Can you get a light?
Okay, maybe? Let me take a look here.
Sure.
So take a look at that.
Yeah, yep,
okay.
That's it.
Is that better?
That's it.
Good,
that's
what you're getting. Okay, Sammy, what are you doing?
I think I got it.
Oh, okay, cool. All right, now, before you guys give up on trying to understand how single-celled organisms work, I wanna issue one piece of advice in regards to single-celled organisms. A single-celled organism just has one cell. Okay, so don't mess around with it and make fun of it because it only has one cell. You might be multicellular, but there's no need to be cellulist. I'm serious about that. Okay, guys, turn to page 55. Snap, 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 smappity bap, bap, boopy doop. Okay, great. Now, do you see the section on mitosis? Everybody, look at your microscopes, and I want you to see if you can see some cellular division.
Let's face it, there was a bishop in the Middle Ages there, 1800 something, who added up the dates listed in Genesis, and he came up with the world had been around for 6,000 years. There ain't no way that's possible. You know, anybody that's in the oil business knows that he's drilling down. You drill down 2 miles, 3 miles, 4 miles underground. You're coming into all these layers that are laid down by the dinosaurs. And we have skeletons of dinosaurs that go back about 65 million years. And to say that it all came about in 6,000 years is just nonsense. And I think the time we come off of that stuff and say this isn't possible. God's in control, and he is the author of all life. But we've got to be realistic that the dating of Bishop Usher just doesn't comport with anything that is found in science. And you know, you can't just totally deny the geological formations that are out there, the rock formations and all the things that go all over the world, especially the bones. And we have found a Tyrannosaurus rex out there in the Oregon or someplace. I mean, a full skeleton. But this thing, you know, we just can't be playing this Usher. Bishop Usher, God bless him, rest his soul in peace. He was just off.
Amiri Baraka is swirling in the heavens tonight. Amiri Baraka is arguing with Halley's Comet as we speak, because Halley's Comet's white and is dominating his ass. Mary Baraka is a poet, a dramatist, an educator, a didact, and an all-around cultural guy who passed away. And he wrote a play called The Dutchman that won an Obie Award in 1964 about a middle-class black guy meeting a white woman on a subway train. And it's most powerful. That was when I first became aware of him, when I was in college and saw two people put it on as a two-hander in my drama class. And it was staggering in its honesty and brutal, brutal emotional realism. The thing about Amiri Baraka is that he's not an easy pill for a lot of people to swallow because he's coming from a place of brutal honesty. Let me put it that way. Some people might think he was anti-Semitic, racist, homophobic, a lot of different things. I think, in the end, poets are characterizing because they have to illustrate. And illustrating is not always easy. Lou Reed, the sainted Lou Reed, who passed last year, was the poet laureate of the streets of the United States and the only great rock artist to really delve into the underclass in the insane way that he did. Bob Dylan is a poet of extraordinary power, and there's many poets, Joni Mitchell and whatnot, that are tremendous rock artists. But Lou Reed is the one who talked about transgender people and transvestites and junkies and homosexuals. And in the same way, analogous to that, Mary Baraka talked about the black race, what the relationship was to society and all that. Here, let me just read a little bit of the obituary from the Los Angeles Times today, and then a couple of very quick poems. Writer and activist Amiri Baraka died Thursday after weeks of failing, blah, blah, blah. A playwright, poet, critic, and activist. He was one of the most prominent and controversial African-American voices. Controversial because he f***ed people off. Controversial means that white academics and the press didn't agree with you. Does it mean he's right? You be the judge of that. That's more than I can judge. What I know is this. When women are mouthy, and when black people are mouthy, and when the underclass is mouthy and speaks truth to power, they're controversial. Is George Bush a controversial president? When he dies, will that be the headline? Will it say, George W. Bush passes, controversial president, led us into two bizarre wars and ignored Katrina?
Better be.
It better be, but it won't be. You know what it'll say. A 44th president, son of another president. This laconic, coke-snorting draft dodger was one of the great Americans of the greater half of the first 20th century. By stealing an election by force, using his Republican thug operatives, George W. Bush was able to steal two terms in this country, using America as his own banana republic and enriching all of his friends at the same time, followed by Barack Obama, who people believed at the time wasn't co-opted and bought by all the corporations, but then later let everyone down by living up to few of his promises, other than the medical here. You know, I mean, no one will ever say that. No one ever says Reagan was a controversial president. Reagan was under investigation the entirety of his second term and had hundreds of people dismissed and resign in disgrace out of his administration. It was an absolute scandal. And now you hear people come on TV and go, Ronald Reagan was... he was born Everett Leroy Jones. He was known as Leroy Jones for the first half of his career. A gifted student, he went to New York University in Howard, serving in the Air Force for 2 years. He was dishonorably discharged. Would you like to know why? For reading communist texts. And the land of the free and the home of the... Play ball! He moved to New York. He edited a magazine with Hetty Cohn. They were married from 60 to 65. It was a magazine called Jürgen. He was at the graduate school, even involved in the beat scene. They published Burroughs, Ginsberg, Corso, Kerouac, Diane De Prima, John Ashbery, Frank O'Hara, Gary Snyder, Gilbert Sorrentino, Barbara Guest, William Carlos Williams, and others. He also co-edited a literary newsletter, The Floating Bear, published Blues... Oh, I need that. After the 1965 assassination of Malcolm X, he changed his name to Imamu Amiri Baraka, moved to Harlem and married his second wife, Amina, inspired by a 60 trip to Cuba. We wrote art that was, number one, identifiably Afro-American according to our roots and our history and so forth. Secondly, we made art that was not contained in small venues. The third thing we wanted was that art would help with the liberation of black people. And we didn't think just writing a poem was sufficient. That poem had to have some kind of utilitarian use. It should help in liberating us. So that's what we did. We consciously did that. Baraka led the Black Arts Movement, an aesthetic sibling to the Black Panthers. Although the movement was fractious and short-lived, it involved significant authors such as Gwendolyn Brooks, Eldridge Cleaver, Gil Scott-Heron, Nikki Giovanni, Ishmael Reed, and Quincy Troupe. And we've talked quite a lot on the show about Gil Scott-Heron over the years and read his poetry from time to time. It would behoove you to dig this part of American history. It wasn't so much that Amiri Baraka is the preeminent poet of this generation. It isn't so much that Amiri Baraka is anything eminent, as much as he's an African-American poet who took a political stance, and it's important for you to know who he is, because the mainstream media is not going to give him the giant eulogy that they're going to give other people. They're going to call him controversial and make him a footnote. And in my opinion, it's imperative that we remember that people have to fight for freedom all the time, and that people fight for freedom in many ways. Not only do they fight for freedom as political activists, but they fight as artists as well, and poets. When people tell you, oh, artists should stick to their art and just do what they do and just perform and don't ever talk about politics. He became involved deeply. He used to send trucks out in Harlem and have Sun Ra, the jazz artist, play on them. It was a real an outreach. Baraka made his home in Newark, New Jersey, and remained a creative political force. He was New Jersey's second poet laureate. Did you know New Jersey ever had a poet laureate? My balls, both of them, they ache. Ouch. This is a haiku that I have written. From Secaucus to Cherry Hill, from Underwood to Newark, from Trenton all the way up the bay. Joyzy, 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 in my ears it doth ring. He was the poet laureate of New Jersey. After 9/11, he wrote a poem called Someone Blew Up America. I'm not going to read it to you tonight, but I would like you to go home and read it on your own. It's called Somebody Blew Up America. You can see him doing it on YouTube Live. You can also read the words if you like. There was a lot of controversy over the poem. I will allow you to go read that on your own rather than poison you with my opinion on it. Suffice to say that he reiterates a constant theme on this show, which is that there is no telling the dastardly deeds of our governments and all the governments of all time, because they are not for the people and of the people and by the people. Here's a couple of poems that I think you'll like by Amiri Baraka. Monday in B-flat. It's quite short. I can pray all day and God won't come, but if I call 911, the devil be here in a minute. This one's at Penn Station in New York City. It's an excerpt from one of his poems. If you go to New York City and you travel in Penn Station, you'll see that there's poetry etched in the walls there, which is most remarkable. And this is the poem that's up there. I have seen many suns use the endless succession of hours piled upon each other. And I'll read you what it says underneath it. Amiri Baraka, controversial author and activist. this is from Matt Taibbi in the Rolling Stone. Matt Taibbi is a tremendous a journalist who writes for the Rolling Stone, of all things. This is about the HSBC settlement that HSBC, the giant banking entity, had to pay for their involvement in the drug war. Just to hip you to the jive, Colorado made $5 million in the first week of having recreational marijuana. You're going to see that the untold profits that can be had, that can be worked into the school system to support Shakespeare and whatnot, and maybe help people, will come from marijuana. The banking laws in this country prevent the legal dope dealers in Colorado who have legal dope operations now, right? Because it's legal in the state of Colorado. The federal government still has banking laws that don't allow them to put their money in banks. So they pay their IRS bill with giant bags of cash. So that has to be rectified, and I'm guaranteeing you that Oregon, Alaska, Nevada, and California are going to have recreational marijuana in the near future. Well, I'm not guaranteeing you. I'm saying that it's going to happen. In 20 years' time, we won't be having this discussion. Is it a discussion? No, it's mostly me talking, but were it a discussion, we wouldn't be having it. Matt Taibbi writes, and this is from a month ago, if you've ever been arrested on a drug charge, if you've ever spent a day in jail for having a stem of marijuana in your pocket or drug paraphernalia in your gym bag, Assistant Attorney General and longtime Bill Clinton pal Lanny Brewer has a message for you. Bite me. Brewer signed off on a settlement deal with the British banking giant HSBC that is the ultimate insult to every ordinary person who's ever had his life altered by a narcotics charge. Despite the fact that HSBC admitted to laundering billions of dollars for Colombian and Mexican drug cartels, among others, and violating a host of important banking laws, from the Bank Secrecy Act to the Trading with the Enemy Act, Brewer and his Justice Department elected not to pursue criminal prosecution of the bank, opting instead for a record financial settlement, and the record's in quotes, of $1.9 billion. It is about 5 weeks of income for the bank. 5 weeks. A year is 52 weeks. So it is 10% of a year's income is what they've been forced to pay for dealing and laundering money for drug cartels in Colombia and elsewhere. If you have cocaine tonight, and I've said it before on the show, one, make yourself known to me. Two, if you are apprehended while you are walking down the streets and the cops see you smoking a J and they pull you over, you'll be incarcerated. And if you have drugs on you of any kind, you're going to go to jail and you're going to have to deal with the legal system. HSBC, the giant banking corporation, is not dealing with it. And that is my point all the time. And that is Matt Taibbi's point, and that's the point of what's wrong with America. If you want to talk about inequity, the fact that women are second-class citizens, the fact that the poor are denigrated and spat upon, and that corporations do not pay their fair share and are never asked to participate in the legal justice system the way we are asked to participate in the legal justice system. What's the appropriate financial penalty for a bank in their position? Exactly how much money should one extract from a firm that has been shamelessly profiting from business with criminals for years and years? Remember, we're talking about a company that has admitted to a smorgasbord of serious banking crimes. If you're the prosecutor, you've got this bank by the balls, how much money should you take? And this is what Matt Taibbi suggests. How about all of it? Yeah. How about every last dollar the bank has made since it started its illegal activity? How about you dive into every bank account of every single executive involved in this mess and take every last bonus dollar they've ever earned? They take their houses, their cars, the paintings they bought at Sotheby's, the clothes in their closets, the loose change in their jars on the kitchen counters, every last thing. Take it all and don't think twice and then throw them in jail. Sound harsh? It does, doesn't it? The only problem is that's exactly what the government does every day to ordinary people in ordinary drug cases. Anthony Smelly, the Indiana resident who won $50,000 in a car accident settlement and was carrying $17,000 of that cash in his car when he got pulled over. Cops searched his car and had drug dogs sniff around. The dogs alerted twice. No drugs were found. The police took the money anyway. After Smelly produced documentation proving where he got the money, they tried to keep the money on the grounds he could have used the money to buy drugs in the future. Seriously, that happened? It happens all the time. Lanny Brewer's Justice Department. In 2010, the U.S. Attorney's Office deposited $1.8 billion into government accounts as a result of forfeiture. Forfeiture means they take all of your assets, your car, your house, and everything because you've got drugs on you. You can see the Justice Department statistics right there. If you get pulled over in America with cash and the government thinks it's drug money, that cash is going to be buying your local sheriff or police chief a new Ford Expedition tomorrow afternoon. And the other day when Brewer was announcing a slap on the wrist, I was in arraignment court for Brooklyn watching how they deal with actual people. A public defender explained the absurdity of drug arrests in New York City. New York has a fairly liberal laws. Police aren't supposed to bust you. How do the police work around that to make 50,377 pot-related arrests in a single year? On the other hand, if you're an important person and you work for a big international bank, you won't be prosecuted even if you launder $9 billion. Even if you actively collude with the people at the very top of the international narcotics trade, your punishment will be far smaller than the very person at the very bottom of the world drug pyramid. You'll be treated with more deference and sympathy than a junkie passing out in a subway car in Manhattan. An international drug trafficker is a criminal and usually a murderer. The drug addict walking the streets, one of his victims. Thanks to Brewer, we're now in the business officially of jailing the victims and enabling the criminals. That's what Matt Taibbi has to say about that.
Greg Proops, from his weekly live podcast, The Smartest Man in the World, which I highly recommend for your regular listening. Check it out. Earlier, following Reggie Watts' new series, Teach, was Pat Robertson dissing young earth creationism, which is bad for business on both sides of his grifty enterprises. Overeasy on some early Pink Floyd. This has been the Inner Side Radio Program, Pacifica Radio's Guilty Pleasure. My name is Scooter, and I'll see y'all next week.